Welcome once again to another episode of the Scrumcast over at TrollBloodScrum.com, where the only minion unit we like as much as in-faction choices are the Nude Hunters. We are joined once again by the Pressganger, formerly known as the Mm-hmm Guy. Also joining us again from Wales is Baka Ryu, and our super special guest for this month. You know him. You love him. He's very angry on the forums. Pressganger Pete Gurr, Mr. Peter Lippert. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
I am made out of rage.
Well, gentlemen, it's going to be another exciting cast, as you can expect, but we're going to go ahead and start with Pete. Pete, give us a little bit of insight as to what brought you to the faction.
I was at a comic shop playing L5R, Legend of the Five Rings, and one of my buddies was playing Kador. And it looked really interesting, and he started just wearing me down about playing it. And like 3 months later, I started playing, and I asked him, you know, what was back in Mark 1, says like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. He's like, what is the, like, kind of like the low-end faction? What faction, like, you know, is kind of hard to learn? He's like, ah, Trollblood seem like they're kind of hard. And I liked them, and I love that orc look. I always play like the ugly, hard-to-play faction. That's always been my thing for some reason. And I started with Trollbloods, and I played them exclusively for about 3 or 4 years till I moved to Toledo and had to play against all the Detroit guys forever, and that expanded me into some other factions, and now I kind of play everything except for, let's see, Crix and Legion.
Nice. How long have you been a Pressganger?
Like 3.5 years now? Maybe almost four?
Oh, no, not quite 3 years. We got approved in the same month.
Oh, you're right. We did get approved in the same month. So we still 3 years?
Not quite.
Not quite? Okay.
Right. No, more like just a few months shy.
A few months shy, 3 and 9. It all runs together. It's back in Toledo time.
I could have sworn we were salty dogs or something.
Well, we won't get our special medals.
No.
Well, it really just chalks you up to both being old, though I think I probably am right in the same area with you there, Pete. at any rate, well, let's go ahead and move right on into a little segment I like to call Pass the Keg. I'm going to present to you guys a little bit of a conundrum that came up against me in a recent Wrath release event. It was a 35-point event, and it presented me with kind of an issue because a number of my lists lacked a certain piece in the army that would make this very easy. Now, without dealing with this very important piece are a Stone Bearer and Stone Scribe Elder. I would like you to deal with this particular issue. You are facing in a Wrath release event a Crix player with a unit of Black Bane's Ghost Raiders who are incorporeal, and all he is intent to do is run his units beyond your units into your trench and capture and capture your objective. And Pete, take it away.
What caster are you playing, or are we hypothetically playing?
This is hypothetical. How would you deal with it?
Hypothetically, depending on who I was playing, the easy answer is just, you know, I'm going to play Gunborn and throw AoEs at him, but with Explosivo. But if you're not doing that, because honestly, there's not that much Gunborn being played, your best bet is to, let's see, I'd probably stick back a little bit if I was doing enough infantry, if I had, like, Finblades or Creel Warriors, something of that nature. Just sort of kind of honeycomb them to make sort of a big blob that there wasn't a lot of sticking ground in to kind of get them engaged. But without knowing exactly what the list is, that's kind of, it's a tough question. That's a tricky one.
It is, and this is a conundrum that I ran up against with one list. All right, Mike, how would you deal with it?
Well, if the Creel Stone isn't an option, and I almost never run my list without the Creel Stone, then I would probably go with facing them off with Rune Shapers and Calandra, because they can't run through them because of Force Lock, and they have the magic weapons and spells to deal with them.
Not a bad choice, Dallas. What do you think?
Well, I think, and I'm cheating because this is what I did in the Wrath release event, but I think I'd turn it right back around on him and throw down a little bit of Jarl Scold with some Quickened Longriders and go for his trench. I think I'm faster than he is.
I think you actually might be right there. So to bring it back around, this is exactly what happened to me. I was facing a number of normal opponents, and I heard some whisperings about this happen. And then when I drew my next opponent and I had my list on the table, I realized, oh my god, my stone was not present, and I knew I was going to have to deal with this. And I did exactly what you did, Pete, is I honeycombed my my fen blades in front of him to slow him down as much as I possibly could so that he didn't have a place to place them. And it enabled me to contest his trench and move enough stuff into mine to basically switch flanks and move the game around. And incorporeal models in certain scenarios like that are very, very trying. And that one particularly gave me a very hard game.
Well, the worst part is if you try and run through them, like if you have Long Riders and Jarl, you're awesome because you can just kind of skirt them because you have so much movement. But if you try and go through them, they get, even though they're incorporeal, they get ganged
free strikes
on you.
Now, granted, the unit becomes corporeal at that point, but they lose nothing from doing that, really.
And quite possibly kill something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then they're engaged, and they're making more pirates because they're there. And if they don't kill whatever they've hit, it's on fire. So they create quite a conundrum. There have been some rumblings in the Crix forums about them not being particularly good, but, I mean, in presenting your opponent with tough choices, I think they are A number one with that one.
I remember before I'd come up with an idea for like an epic Gorshade list, which the entire army was just self-regenerating, where it just had them and, well, the solo as well, I forget his name, the captain of the Ecrementus. That's it, Rengrave. And then obviously you had the pirates, and then you also have Tartarus and Bane Knights, and you also have Bane Thralls, which with the elite cadre from epic Gorshade, your entire army gains models when it kills things.
Yeah, it is quite the... Oh, man. It's very difficult to deal with. And I'm surprised I don't see them more, especially in low-point games, where you'll see, number one, not an abundance of magic weapons in most factions outside of a Warlock or Warcaster. And number two, if you're in a scenario, I mean, if you can't kill a model that's contesting a scenario, what are you supposed to do about it, really, at that point? It's very difficult to deal with.
I think you would see more if Protectorate didn't exist.
Because
it's such a hard counter. It's like, oh, I have incorporeal stuff. Well, I've got magic everything. You can just go die. Because I'll just be over here shooting you with these crossbows, and you'll be over there.
Die. Well, and all things considered, trolls as well. Because really, a stone present, all you have to do is sacrifice, sacrifice that stone for a turn to really put the hurt on that unit. Because it does present a threat, even though it's cheap. And doesn't hit particularly hard, it's still a threat there, especially in a scenario game, so.
Yeah, that's why, like, to be fair, it's like even against Signar as well, you know, most of their power casters, like Epic Kane or Normal Kane, or any of the Haleys, Black Banes die very quickly to Chain Lightning spam. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chain Lightning and Gun Mages pretty much wipe them out.
This is very true.
Crix and Kador.
All right, well, we're going to go ahead and move on to our next section. Well, Pete, I know you very soon are going to be going to Neon Con down there in Vegas, so go ahead and fill us in about that. I honestly don't know a single thing about it. I just saw the banner pop up under your forum post, and I was actually kind of curious, so I figured you could enlighten our listeners and kind of give us a new view on the con.
Yeah, sure. Neon Con used to be a big RPG con. It was a big, like, Pathfinder, 4th Edition, Death Watch. You'd see Dark Heresy. Just a huge sort of board game and RPG convention. And then last year, there was a little bit of War Machine sprinkled in, but there was no real promotional effort behind it. This year, we're trying to make it a bit bigger, and so I've teamed up with Mr. Ross Thompson, formerly of Privateer Press, now of Cool Minis or Not, and the former owner of one of the most glorious beards in all the land. He and I are trying to push miniatures for the first time, like legitimately push it. And so we're getting a good amount of space, a couple 32-man tournaments, a qualifier. I'm pushing out a ton of prize support. I've been saving up PG points for almost a year to put stuff to it. We got a whole 35-point Magnus Bad Seeds theme list for the winner, and Foam, and a bunch of cool stuff from Cool Mini or Not that Ross is throwing in. And just, you know, some kind of, you know, your standard Vegas stuff like casino dice. And I'm just trying to really push it to the next big end-of-the-year con. And unfortunately, it hit the same year as War Machine Weekend. And next year, we're hoping to get that sorted out a little earlier so that we can have sort of the year start with Kingdom Con down in San Diego and kind of end with Neon Con here in Vegas.
That'd be awesome. So how many years has Neon Con been running?
On and off, it went for about 7 or 8 years, but as a constant every year thing, about 6 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, but outside the board game and RPG community, just no one really heard of it, and so this year is more about just getting the word out that, yeah, there's miniature games, because before all they had was 40K, and I will burn Vegas to the ground before I let 40K have a bigger tournament than War Machine.
So is this going to be more of a small, localized kind of con like Lock and Load was, where they rent a conference center and basically run it out of that?
Sort of. I think it might be a bit larger than Lock and Load, not hugely. It's at the Tropicana Hotel and Casino. Mm-hmm. It's in their grand ballroom. I think the best stage of scale would kind of be like if anyone's ever been to like the first year of Adepticon. It'll be, I think, about that size. So just like one big grand ballroom, and then an exhibitor's hall. And the exhibitor's hall where fabulous local stores like my place, Battlezone Comics, will be there, and they will be selling privateer stuff. You'll have Ross and his cool mini minions out there selling some fun games like Relic Knights and Dark Age, which is something I really enjoy. It's another great little D20-based game that's like a little fast skirmish game. But it'll be about that Adepticon kind of size, with not the latest one, because I hear that Travis made it extra big this year. So it won't be that big, but we're hoping next year something that size.
Well, speaking on your store, actually, that was something that I had really hoped to see this year at both PAX and Lock and Load, was more of a retailer spotlight kind of thing, an area for shops, local shops, like the places that you and I and everybody else go to play, to come up and set up shop and, you know, basically give people an idea what they bring to the table, you know, give some more information about the shop owners, what they have in stock, and, you know, what they can bring to players in the area. I know that in my area there is such a huge inherent value to a space like that, because it will increase your player base. I live in the Seattle area, actually across a ferry, but one thing that is very prevalent in my area is the Navy population, and if there's one thing to say about the Navy population is a lot of times they're very bored and they have a lot of disposable income, which means that you really have a lot more hobby dollar to spend, and if people know you're there, they are much more apt to it's come and buy your product, really. And if you're at a con like that, something that draws not just local but national attention, it's just as valuable as local advertising, say, on cable TV or what have you. I really would like to see, like you guys have at cons, more local representation for shops. Because I really, really like my local shop, which is Avalon Comics and Games in Silverdale, Washington. But to be honest, most shops like that, their base income is going to be comics first and foremost, and the wargaming is just kind of a side effect of it, despite the fact that they have tables and play space and things like that.
You have to have the right. And I was in Toledo. There's a great, if you're ever in Ohio at all, the best game store probably in Ohio is this place called The Game Room in Toledo, and it's a humongous space. It's like good 6,000 square feet. And it's just one whole huge room is comics, but then this other gigantic room is nothing but tables, and it's War Machine, and it's 40K, and it's Flamesborn, and it's everything. But to talk about the local presence at a con, the guy who runs that store, Daryl, has been running that store for like 25 years, like one of the oldest comic stores in the Midwest. Yeah. Oldest comic and game, started as a game store, added comics later, and now he makes, you know, most of his money off of games and snack sales, and then comics kind of comes in third. But he would go to little cons like Origins, which is a specific kind of, you know, if you've ever been to Origins, it's kind of a dinky Ohio con. It's just
I've heard a couple tables.
But he would go to Origins, and he would do one of the smartest things I've ever seen. He would bring his bits box. He would bring his bits box for War Machine and for 40K, and he would sell used models. And he would come back and he'd be like, "Oh, Peter, I just got back from Origins, and it was okay this year. I only made about 7,000." He's like, "Daryl, shut up."
Holy crap, that's amazing.
But that's the big, and I understand why Privateer doesn't do it, because, you know, your best profit is going to be direct sales. If you're you wouldn't want, you know, you might want to have a local store be there, like, represented, but you probably wouldn't want them selling things at your con if it's right down the road, because your best dollar value is, you know, straight from your warehouse to a customer.
You know what? I could see that. So,
next year, I'm hoping they just let them at least have, you know, some representation, maybe some banners, just some advertising, just something to drive the consumer base from, "Hey, I had this fun con. Where can I get this stuff besides, you know, just buying it here at the con booth?" And then they can see all their local options, because that's huge for the community.
Well, you know what? They're going to make their dollar regardless of whether or not it's sent through a middleman or a distributor, or, you know, and it gets to a shop, or they, you know, or they sell it at the con there. So it really doesn't hurt them at all to have any sort of representation by local shops there. And honestly, I think that all that will do is garner a better relationship between them and shop owners, and create a better strength in the community, about the product. So really, it's just kind of a win-win there. Now, Mike, in your area, do they allow any shop representation at the events and tournaments there?
Well, the major tournaments, at least the ones that I go to, which is the Welsh Open, which is based down in Cardiff, which is like right down the motorway from me, and the UK Masters, which is held at the convention. And in the convention there, there's a lot of different stores, a lot of different shops and companies basically that purchase like trade space, and they trade at the event. And for the Welsh Open, it's actually held in the local gaming store, which has like a massive gaming hall in the back, which has something like 40, 50 tables.
Nice. Well, it's good to see representation on that kind of a scale. It's one of the things that I've really been missing whenever I've gone to cons in the past, and I think it's kind of something that could really, really kind of bring the game to a new front, really, just to increase this representation.
You know, for me, I living in Utah, we don't have a lot of cons that are really close to us other than Denver and Las Vegas. And the one in Denver doesn't have a really big War Machine presence, and so I'm pretty excited about Peter and his work down in Vegas. That's only about an 8 to 10 hour drive from where I live. That's easily doable for you know, my whole group. So that's exciting. Yeah, that's exciting. See, plus we drive through St. George, it's beautiful. Lots of things to do between here and there.
Yeah, if you want to be really excited to see Utah, try and drive to Vegas from Ohio.
I've done that.
Flat countryside.
I used to live in Columbus. I've done that drive.
Yeah. It is a miserable drive right about till Utah.
Oh, jeez.
You're like, oh, all the good things in life. Mountains, things, sunlight, crap that's not wheat.
Oh, yeah, jeez. The Midwest driving through there is not a super lot of fun. But, I mean, how long was your drive when you were coming out here to Lagermo, Dallas?
From Columbus to Salt Lake City, it's about 32 to 36 hours.
To Lock and Load out here in Seattle. Was it, how long was it?
Oh, our drive to Lock and Load. Hi. The drive to Lock and Load was about 12 and a half hours.
That's not too terrible.
It's a whole day. You know, Vegas, if you go, plus the drive to Vegas, you drive through the desert, so there's no cops. You can go like 100 miles an hour all the way through the Utah desert.
We here at the Scrum do not advocate speeding and or breaking any kind of law. Just to say there.
But you can get to St. George in about 5 hours, and then it's only an hour and a half or two from there to Vegas. So not a bad drive at all for us.
Oh, geez, that's not bad at all. Oh man. You know, hopefully. I'm sorry. What was that?
They're not so bad. It's like getting to my local gaming store, which is Firestone Games, which is the place where, as I said, where the Welsh Open is held. It takes me 45 minutes by train.
So you take public transportation to get down there?
Well, yeah, because it means that if I want to, I can have like drinks and actually enjoy it.
Yeah, trains are awesome. That's the one thing that I miss about the Midwest, is I guess they were so afraid of people just, you know, having to drive forever and just getting depressed and shooting themselves in the face. They're like, oh, we better stop this. We'll put trains there. Because there's trains all over the Midwest, and that is the best way to travel.
Yeah.
You sit there, good transportation, lots of storage. You can drink the whole time or sleep.
Yeah.
Or both, if you're really good at it.
Yeah, transportation in the Northwest is kind of behind the times as far as train travel goes. Really only good travel between Seattle and Portland, and even then, you know, you're still paying a premium for the travel. There is a good convenience, like you guys said, between being able to drink and sleep on the way and then just enjoying the trip. But, you know, public transportation virtues aside, it's just not quite as nice. Well, at any rate, gentlemen, I think we're going to go ahead and move into our first intermission here. thank you for listening, and we'll see you in just a few minutes over here at trollbloodscrum.com. This episode of the Scrumcast is brought to you by Sid's Painting Service, bringing you quality commissioned paintwork since 2011. For more information, please visit www.trollbloodscrum.com. And welcome back to the Scrumcast over at trollbloodscrum.com. We're going to go ahead and swing ourselves back into action with our very own Mike Davies going into our Warlock Spotlight for this podcast. And take it away, Mike.
For the first Warlock Spotlight, I thought I would bring up one of the casters, which on paper seems to offer so much, but unfortunately in tournaments seems to fall short, and that's their Gunnbjorn. I've been running a list recently which I've had a fair amount of success with so far, which is a melee-centric list, complemented purely just by a handful of Warbeasts. Rather than going for the shooty, heavy gospel, which we all go for guided fire, which I've come to discover, at least through my own experience, is a trap. Because, of course, in scenarios, all that firepower is great to bring to bear to be able to clear out the objective, but then you've got nobody to walk in and take the objective afterwards, basically meaning then the opponent just walks back on and scores the point. So The lists that I've been running with have been very melee heavy, champions, Fenblades, and that's backed up by a bomber, which every Gunnbjorn list should have one, I think, and three winter trolls.
Now, I know that there was a version of this popping around in the Dire Brackets League that we've been running, and which is still running, coincidentally, folks. Go ahead and keep an eye on that as it unfolds. But now, the real problem with that is that how do you deal with people who just straight up jam you, and then you've got those Winter Trolls that are just sitting there completely useless?
Well, they're not completely useless at all, because what you do is you just make sure that you get a good angle. You use your Animus on one of the guys, and that's on one guy, and then you just spray straight through him, catching as many enemies as possible. And then each Winter Troll can do that, which adds up to the 6 fury that Gunnbjorn can spend. So the enemies ran up and jammed your lines, and basically all they're going to do is lose a buttload of men to sprays. And then you still, of course, got your front line who can then charge in, and then you've also got 3 Animus going around, which the enemy has to take care of, otherwise you're going to have a bunch of stationary men.
Not too bad. Now, what else is contained in the list?
In the list, they got Champion Scaldi and a hero. It was... Well, one second. I'll just see to whip up my forward commander now, and I'll tell you exactly what's in it.
I just like to see the Winter Trolls getting work again. It's nice.
No,
it's like
you
a stimulus package for bad moms.
Wait.
Now, hold
you
on.
Said,
the Animus,
hold
yeah.
On, hold on. Wait. He said used again, like somebody used him in the first place.
No, the biggest victory to using a Winter Troll, the best tactic, is that when you put him on the table, the dust on it is likely to give your opponent some sort of sneezing fit and render him completely useless for like 2-3 rounds.
There you go.
Or the element of surprise. He'll just be like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. I quit. I'll run nothing but Death Jacks. Or not Death Jacks, I'll run Death Chickens. Nothing but Defilers.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, the Winter Troll's Animus, doesn't that trigger on ending an activation within 2 inches of the target? And
yes.
It's... So if you're already engaged... Oh, you cast it on yourself beforehand. All right, I'm a little slow.
You either cast it beforehand before they reach your lines, because if they run to jam you, then, well, they're just going to trap themselves. Or, as you said, you use it then to spray through your own men without risk of hurting them, because they gain immunity to cold. And then once your Winter Trolls have cleared the front line for you, that's when you have the front line that the enemy had just rushed gets charged and charges through and then just plows into the enemy lines.
And that's not bad when they actually boast reasonably decent defensive stats. Armor 18 under the stone is not bad at all.
No, it's not bad. The only thing that really will gum it up is Satixis, but for some reason I don't see a lot of Satixis lately. Because Satixis will jam at turn 1, and then if you spray them, you're still needing 12s, and it's...
Well, they'll jam at turn 1 if you go first. Otherwise, you'll still have the advantage. Plus, if it's Satixis, you kind of see the writing on the wall, honestly. I mean, they don't have a lot of other applications other than getting in your face and being a nuisance.
Yeah, they're such a good nuisance.
And now that I've finally got my forward commander up, the actual full Gunnbjorn list at 50 points was Gunnbjorn, 3 Winter Trolls, Bomber, Swamp Gobbers, Maximum Champions with Scaldi, Maximum Fenblades with the Officer, and a Champion Hero and a Fellcaller Hero.
At 50 points, right?
And that's a 50-point list.
That's a pretty solid list there. I'm actually seeing your Mad Genius here with the Winter Trolls. It makes sense, because it's very unlikely that they're going to wipe, 46 HP off the board, especially in armor 18, turn 2 or turn 3 whenever they decide to jam you. And, you know, under even precautionary under ranged lists with Gunnbjorn's feet, they're still going to benefit from cover, can't be knocked down, so you could essentially basically save yourself on the way up without losing too much all the way there.
Exactly, and Fenblades, with just no other support except for the Fellcaller Heroes war cry and their mini feats, you're still talking 11-inch charge at Mat 8 for Terror, Pathfinder, Fearless. They'll still be able to rush objectives and Alpha Strike some of the nastier infantry that could be coming your way.
That's quite interesting. Now, the only thing I might see a small problem with is, even with the Fenblades and those mat buffs and the rat buffs, you still might suffer versus certain Death Star lists, particularly KAZ. You'll jam their lines, but when they're stuck in, they'll still be defense almost impossible to hit, even with sprays that are boosted by guided fire. How are you going to deal with those hard-to-hit Kador armies?
Well, hitting Kayazi with sprays is under guided fire hits on averages, because they're only defend 16 melee attacks, and they don't gain the in-melee combat penalty.
This is true, but it's not the combat penalty, it's the engagement penalty. When they're in combat, they're defense 16 plus 3 for...
Only versus melee.
Yeah, they have plus 2 defense against melee attacks.
Oh, it's only
they have duelists.
They have troll animi, so their defense becomes 7.
Well, that was my mistake. I thought it was against all attacks.
No, you Iron Flesh makes them super annoying, but that's going to be the case against anything. But you have the bomber. That's
yes,
a beautiful
Fin Blades.
You have
a bomber to help deal with that, and that's not counting your Winter Trolls.
My favorite way to get rid of Chaos is to just
the main clincher against that kind of super defense lists.
Yeah. Just run up a Finnblade, kind of base-to-base with a couple of them, and throw a bomber. Have a bomber just toss right at that poor Finnblade's back and blow up all the Chaos around him.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of the players in my meta have gotten wise to my ways of dealing with high defense models, unfortunately. And they're very crafty in keeping their models spread out from AoEs or other things.
Honestly, yeah, so I've seen that too, and you just got to kind of hope that they leave enough room to get a target of your own.
Yeah.
You ever have to sacrifice a Finnblade or two, it's always fun just to see their face when it becomes a homing beacon for a bomber.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, who's defense?
That's my best way of dealing with high defense. Target my own crap and AoE slam, throw my own stuff into their high defense model.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the positioning long riders for that specifically, because most of the time people with KAZ are going to be like, all right, I'm going to use this big mini feat and I'm going to get to your caster. Well, they a lot of the time are very hasty in doing so, and you can pretty consistently line up a very nice set of slams on a couple of your long riders, and large bases will take out quite a few of them even on a very short slam.
Yeah, that's why when my friend in like a hardcore practice match I played today, who I think uses his Lord of the Feast incorrectly. Well, a lot of people use the Chaozzi and, well, the Lord of the Feast. They try to use him in an alpha striking capacity. The Lord of the Feast is an outstanding set of mid to end game model. He should be kept back and back and back, and you just wait until you can charge him. He gets his free thresher, kill a bunch of men, gets his heart token, shoots his raven to go into another bunch of people, and just continues on murdering. When you have him on the front line trying to get an alpha strike, he's very easy to pick off. As I did with Pig Burrowers.
The Lord of the Feast is one of those models where people do often just kind of throw him out there. And he's 3 points or 4 points?
4 points.
He's 4 points. That's he's two. Meant to die, but you need to get your money out of him before
he does.
Yeah, exactly.
That's too expensive for him to be on a front line, especially in Circle where you have very cheap, very fast infantry to clog up the lines. The Wolves particularly, I mean, geez, their mini feet gets them there. Why would you just waste something that has such great offensive potential on a very limited return?
Well, against me, he got to do absolutely nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Two Burrowers to the face.
Now, against other ranged heavy lists, aside from running engaging them with Finnblades, do you have any other tactics for dealing with, say, like an E-Haley gunline kind of situation?
Well, I said one of the big advantages that the list has is Gunbjorn's feet in and of itself, and his own wall that he can throw down for you. Because Gunbjorn's feet, you have immunity to blast, cover, immunity to knockdown.
I think the immunity to blast is bigger in his feet than the cover, because it tends to be that the really good range lists don't really care too much about cover, or at least not cover on a defense 12. But the immunity to blast, I find that I get more use out of that than pretty much anything else of that feat.
Yeah, well, it depends. For me particularly, the cover matters a lot more. I don't see a prevalence against AoE spam in my meta, not with Menoth or Cawdor even. I see a lot of direct fire. There's a good prevalence of Signar players, and I see a whole lot of Winnegar Death Star, and that's about it. I don't see a lot of AoE spam. Strangely enough, I haven't seen a whole lot of Harkovich lately, even though he's kind of the new hotness, as it were.
Yeah. The most frustrating list for me to ever play against with Gunbjorn when... first off, I was just going for the ranged beast heavy setup was Retribution, because I was going up against Kaelissa. And, well, against Retribution, generally, Gunbjorn has no feet.
Because they ignore everything.
It's very true. Some E-Lilith lists will do the same kind of thing, but that means you have to have an E-Lilith player first for that to be a problem.
Yeah, and this is true. And then E-Lilith, I mean, after her feet turn, it's about getting there and jamming her up pretty good. And then you've pretty much neutralized all of her range. So that's not too bad. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to now open us up to our newest League, the San Narrows, and some of the models. We're going to be discussing about that one. First and foremost, I'd like to bring up our new Scaldi, the Drinking Buddy model, and how amazing he is. Thoughts on that, guys?
Completely and utterly ridiculous.
Well, that should have been his original model. I'll be honest. He'd have been a lot better in that form. I like Scald. I like him a lot. But for not Scald, Scaldi, I like him a ton. But his League model is really good. Gives the heroes the one benefit that they lack, and that's the lower armor.
Well, not only that, but it's got the Scaldi Drinking Buddy in conjunction with the new Borka tier list becomes crazy as well. Because for every unit of champions you have, the field allowance of champion heroes goes up by one.
Yeah, it's certainly really just kind of it's shoring up a lot of the deficiencies champions had and champion heroes had, and enhancing their strengths. Not only that, but what I was discussing before is that you can very easily leave the champions behind, drag two champion heroes and Scaldi around, and just use them as a super, a super little unit of guys that are, you know, just crazy on the offense. You know?
I think, the thing that I underestimated at first was how good it is with the heroes due to the heroes keeping their tactician. Because normally with Stumbling Drunk, you get boxed in sometimes by your own stuff, and you're like, oh, crap, I'm stuck. But with the tacticians, you can Stumbling Drunk through other heroes if you roll enough movement to get through them.
Well, and technically, Scaldi is still a champion as well, so you can stumble through him. So your formation is really inconsequential. So once you're in there, you're all engaged, you're all super hard to kill, and you're just stumbling through one another willy-nilly and not having to worry about anything in there. So you're avoiding a lot of attacks, you're not taking as much damage as normal, and it really just means that those heroes who most often, once they get the charge off, don't get a lot more mileage out of their abilities because... You know, your opponent doesn't want a power 12 weapon master with reach and thresher just running around the board doing stuff. So they see a lot of fire, but all it really takes is one hit and then they're out of the threat. You know, they won't be taking hits from non-reach units and they'll still be engaged, so they're not at risk from a ranged threat. I mean, what more could you ask for from a solo?
And he tosses on veteran leader champs.
Yeah, makes them better.
Ridiculous icing on the ridiculous cake.
So you're imagining Matt 11 champs charging up the board after Scaldi has charged through a unit of them, completely shielded the whole time. It's the icing on the cake. I mean, he is really the epitome of what we should have gotten with a Scaldi Bonehammer model, in my opinion.
I'm not gonna lie, he might be, or not, he definitely is. Way too good for 3 points. He's so awesome, but he would destroy. Like this would be the model. Like, everyone always gets all hyperbolic about other models, but this would be the model that could potentially really screw up the meta, because he is 3 points of win.
Tartarus levels of offensive power combined with support. You know, and he's 1 point less than Tartarus.
Well, and he hits like a truck regardless.
He's good enough to be a Crix model.
Yeah, exactly. He just doesn't have stealth. That's really the...
he just needs stealth, and he's good.
I just...
Well, now I've given him ideas. Now we're going to have Stumbling Drunk Tartarus soon, so we've done.
Jesus Christ. You know what? No, I'm still hoping. I am still hoping, hope against hope, that tier list actually grants us... Stumbling Drunk on the list.
That would also be the stupidest thing I've ever seen them do.
It'll be amazing.
That said, if that is true, I did not mean that, and I would like to not be kicked out of the press game.
Well, we'll renege that.
I think you should leave that in.
It's a fantastic idea. No, it's great. You guys are on the right track. You have the best design ideas. Loving it. Keep it coming. Just go.
Next team list, I want that tough on a 4-5-6 back.
Oh god damn. Right,
just give us the doc and just we'll get tough on a 4-5-6 instead.
You know what? I'll pay that extra point. Give me my mini feedback. Gah.
the Creel Warriors.
Sad day for the Creel Warriors, indeed. When I was first starting out in Mark 1 and I was using Creels and I was like, oh yeah, this speed is amazing. It buys me time. It's tough to kill them. They don't not get knocked down. And then they took it away. I'm like, they're still good, right? Crap, formation rules are really weird now and I can't just pass this off. And if I do keep my formation close so that I can pass it off and... Yeah, it's just, it's weird. I wept a little that day because Creel Warriors.
For me, it was the combination Kalandra change and Creel Warrior change because you run them up, and on one turn, they're tough on 4, 5, and 6, and then the very next turn, they're tough on 3, 4, 5, and 6. Oh, they were so awesome.
Yeah. Well, are you kidding? Can you imagine how frustrating it must have been for the opponent to be going against an army of Space Marines?
Well, I remember those old shenanigans. It's funny, actually, because of the no-knockdown part of Kalandra's old feat, too. I once had a single champion make 22 tough rolls in a row. which was pretty amazing.
It's much easier to get that tough chain going.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
in fact, when she cast Soothing Song as many times as you wanted.
Oh, God. Yeah, she used to be the Beast Warlock. It was like, yeah, you do me. Oh my god, Kalandra, you're just actually better at running all beasts.
Yeah, because I remember I played like there was a tournament that was an escalating points value and used a different caster every time. And this is back in Mark 1. And the last points value was 950 points. And I had just taken Kalandra and I had like Mauler, Earthborn, Bouncer, Winter Troll, Slag Troll. You know, I just had like millions of trolls everywhere, and then just a couple of units of infantry. My champion spent that entire game duking it out with a unit of Manowar Shock Troopers, gradually killing them one at a time, because it took ages to get through the shield wall.
Yeah, well, you had to build up that champ chain. You had to make sure that you hit with the first attack. Or if you didn't hit with the second attack, so you could get the bonus for the next guy, you know, over and over and over again, and really make sure that you get the most bang for your buck out of the last model in that chain. I do remember a game against a friend of mine who was playing Legion, and I had managed to line up a charge against his caster, and I had landed all four previous hits in my champ chain, and... You know, by the end of it, with a rage-buffed champion swinging on Thagarosh at armor 17, it wasn't long before I took that down because I was all over the board attacking his beasts and clearing things out, and it just kind of, it was an amazing synergy, and I kind of missed that a little bit.
I still remember the one game when I had a power 21 Weapon Master Champion Hero charging. Glorious times.
Yeah, it's, man. The Mark I nostalgia is funny. We all look back on all these ridiculous things, and yet we...
But then we remember the amount of bookkeeping.
And not only that, but we remember how really not competitive we were, sadly. Yes.
Mark II was... We lost some fun stuff, but we gained being viable.
Yeah,
that swap.
And that's one of the weird contentious things that I've looked at recently is that we have gained so many tools and such versatility, and we've rounded out our faction so thoroughly, and yet we still see so little representation in competitive play. It's odd. We see Legion and even Circle, who was considered to not be that great. We've got, you know, Lord Tyrant Watts, who's running around with his Scorn. There's a lot of representation there, but Trolls, who are supposedly rated by a lot of, you know, very reputable sources to be, you know, among the top five factions, and yet we still haven't had a top placing in any major con. I'm kind of startled.
With Trolls, the things that win cons right now are things that specialize sort of at doing like one or two things amazingly. And Trolls are this awesome, balanced, sort of a jack-of-all-trades kind of a faction at the moment, which is great, but the stuff that we tend to hit sometimes in tournament settings is that stuff that's just got that, you know, it does one thing to a degree that we just can't stand up to. But, you know, we've had some success. Like, I remember Chuck called me to rub it in my face when he won Hardcore at Gen Con with his E-Doomy list. And we've had, and Flans came pretty close winning Hardcore a while ago with P-Doom Shaper.
Yeah.
But it just seems like there's so many... We have some lists that they're not bad matchups, but they're just not the greatest ones, and they're the ones that people tend to bring. But I'm hoping with like recent changes to stuff that we'll fare kind of better next year. We also tend to get stuck in a rut with our list building. It seems like we go through phases of like remember a year ago, like every tournament list was like burrowers, more burrowers, and you know, bring a second unit of burrowers, and when your opponent's not looking, put them on the board behind your other burrowers.
Yeah, I can see that. And honestly, I have to say, Lock and Load, I fell victim to a lot of that list building. It didn't stop me from, you know, doing reasonably well. But at the same time, sometimes I feel like we are a little bit limited in that. I feel like we have just recently been gifted all of these things that are very, very good. And they're very, very good in a very wide capacity. The problem is that there's only maybe two of them or three of them. And everybody knows what they do. And that's everybody knows how to deal with it. And there's no variation in that. And that locks us into that list building.
Yeah. It's the Mark One, yeah, they had to learn how to deal with the I remember the only one that really worked really well in Mark One was the Borka Bomb. And that went on for, you would see that for like a whole year in Mark when everyone would be doing like the Borka Toss of Death. But then people would just like, oh, the Borka Bomb's coming. And it was kind of like, the Burrowers, they did pretty well at first, and people were like, oh, Burrowers are coming. And Finn Blades, I think, are kind of reaching that point where everyone's like, oh, they're awesome, but people are like, oh, Finn Blades, I better jam my unit in there first now. So I get, that sounded terrible, but jam my series of pewter models in there first.
All I have to say, guys, is leave your Krill Stones at home. They are fantastic, but you don't have to bring them in every list.
You know what? What else am I going to spend 4 points on that's as potent is really the question.
That's true. If I bring them for the Elder.
What was that?
If I bring them, it's for the Elder more than the armor.
That's true. Jeez, strength. Strength and no freaking incorporeal stealth when I need it.
That stuff is...
See, and again, Dallas, I didn't hear your response, though. What would I take instead that's as potent for 4 points?
Winter Troll.
No.
5 points still.
Oh, jeez. You know, you drop those 4 points, and you have that little bit of extra space to max out a unit of Creels or bring in a minimum unit of Burrowers that you weren't going to bring before. I've already got the Fel Color, so a minion of Burrowers is fantastic. I'd rather have that than a Krill Stone, I think. I don't like being, like, feeling like I'm forced to play a certain thing, or yeah, that's why you find me on the forums always touting how good models are that people hate, because if nobody's playing them, then I'm going to play them, because I can't see them being as bad as everyone says, so I play them until they work.
I can't say two Skinners.
Two Skinners rock.
You know what? You know what Skinners have done for me? You know what? All they've ever been is a deterrent. It's like, I don't want to get charged by that, so I guess I'll just position a little differently. And if I get charged by it, meh.
Hey, I gotta tell you, I'm gonna say it right now. The guys of my leagues are leery of bringing their Hordes armies because they know they're gonna face up against Grimm and 5 Skinners. I'm telling you, it works.
I use them as like a piece of match.
If you remember, in our game, one Skinner did charge a Blitzer and did do 22 points of damage.
Wait, that was our game, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that vaguely. I just remember you beating my face in, though. That was really what highlighted my...
pass off. Every time they do something good, everyone just magically forgets it. But they do something bad, and
it's pasted
all over the wall.
Look. The problem with this is still that they are a model that people, yes, they will be wary of. But when you know what they can do, they aren't as scary. proper application of a model dictates that you could use them effectively. Doing so means that you're probably not going to have them out on a flank, which might have been their design intent. The reality is that you're going to have them sitting behind your lines, waiting for the proper moment to go charge some beast and turn the game in your favor.
Okay. Here's the last time I played two Skinners, I played up against the Circle Army. And I kept my Skinners right up kind of in the middle of my unit of fin blades. So there was a few fin blades in front that are going to die, and then a few in back. And so I got up in there, and he had the Satyr that counter slams. He had a pure blood and a feral wolf and a Gorax. And he opened up on my front line, and then I charged my Alt-Nashley shot, and I charged my Skinners in, and there was no more Gorax and a half-dead Satyr. I'm just saying.
That's fun. I use them like I kind of as a peace offering when I play. If I'm playing like a newer player, and he's like kind of new to the game, and he sees me playing my troll list, and he's like, "Oh crap, are you gonna power game me? Are you gonna like run?" It's like, no, look, it's all right. I'm playing Skinners. It's okay.
Oh, boo.
I do the same. And honest to God, that's the last time I use this. I can't even say his name anymore. A Skinner and a Winter Troll. It was against a newer player to be like, man, I don't want to. Like, I'm teaching him the game. He doesn't want me to go easy on him. But at the same time, it's like, oh, well, I know. I'll play
Skinners. Are people going to even listen to our podcast? We've touted Skinners and Winter Trolls in the same podcast. That means I should talk about my next section for us. What did you call it?
All right. So, and Dallas, that was a fantastic segue. It was an amazing segue.
In the business, that would be a money segue.
Oh, man, that was fantastic. All right, ladies and gentle trolls, we are going to go ahead and move into our final section for the podcast. We're going to call it Crackpot Theory with our very own Dallas Johnson. Dallas, take it away.
Crackpot. So it's
called Crackpot section, then.
Right, because the crackpot's doing it. So my crackpot theory, Like I said a little bit ago, if you've been on the Privateer Press forums at all, and you go in the troll thread, you know if everyone in the thread's bashing on something like scattergunners, there will be a small voice in the corner named the Great Blah telling everybody how good scattergunners are. and lo and behold, a little UA comes along and everyone's singing my song, but they worked before the UA. But I digress. What I want to talk about today is sluggers. I've been bound and determined to find a way to make sluggers not only work, but be effective. And, you know, the obvious choice with sluggers is you know, they have some serious issues because they don't want to move to be really strong. But if they do move, then our own models and crap get in the way. So what I wanted to figure out was a way to make them really work and overcome those weaknesses. Now, the obvious is Gunborn with Snipe, but you know, Gunborn, I found just I like Gunborn. He's fun to play, but he's not competitive. And so I started running my sluggers with Jarl Skuld, and I've decided that sluggers with Tactical Supremacy are probably one of the best uses for Tactical Supremacy that I've come up with yet. Now, don't poo-poo it. I know Tactical Supremacy is good on, like, Champions or whatever, but I toss Quicken on my Long Riders, I toss Wield Secrets on my Krill Warriors, and I they each run one flank, and then my sluggers just kind of walk up the middle, shoot, and then once everyone's done, they'll move their 3 inches. I'm telling you, it gets them up the field, and they get to take their 3 shots, and POW 13 shots with those guys are pretty fantastic with Rat 7.
That's not too bad, actually, what I'm looking at.
No, it's like a slow-mo bushwhack.
No, actually, it's not even just a slow-mo bushwhack, especially with Jarl, though. It shores up a lot of their problems, mostly because their survivability was one of the big issues. So, you run first turn. You have a really unlikely chance of them getting picked off entirely with 5 wounds on your first turn. Second turn, they move up. They might not be in range. Then you can judge whether or not you need to play conservatively with them. So, then that third turn is your big turn. then you're able to move up, shoot, and do that. And then its feet turn, so you've popped clouds in front of everything. Everything that's engaging is protected because you've got clouds on top of it. And then you've got sluggers that are sitting there ready to aim next turn and have better shots at a better rat, and they don't have to worry about they don't have to worry about shot selection because they can see through all those clouds.
Hey, what are they going to do? Take care of your scatter gun or take care of your sluggers with fin blades bearing down on one side and long riders bearing down on the other? Now, you're going to get unobstructed shots with those sluggers.
Well, that's the big thing with Jarl. I think the coolest thing with his feat is the whole being able to see through obstacles and potentially your own models in those clouds, because the big thing they run into is they get line of sight gummed up like crazy unless you're just going to shoot at big, heavy jacks.
Yeah, so that way you can shoot at stuff behind the lines if the clouds are on the front line.
You can actually shoot at stuff that actually cares about unboosted POW 13s, because before it's like, oh, I can hit this Marauder from, oh, it doesn't care, never mind. But now it's like, oh, I can hit this, like, you know, Errant that I didn't have line of sight to before because of the feet. I can do damage to stuff that isn't a big, like, armor 19 target.
Yeah, exactly.
POW 13s, you throw enough POW 13s at most light beasts or jacks in this game, and they're crying for their mommies about halfway through that unit.
No, I agree, and I love the idea of not pairing with Gunborn, because putting sluggers with Gunborn is like trying to guard dynamite with fire. It's just not gonna work out. It's like, I have this bad thing.
And it's painting a target on a unit too with Gunbjorn specifically, because hey, I've put snipe on this unit that I want to sit and shoot things. Oh, by the way, they only have range 10.
So hey, I know everyone, if you go to the Privateer Press forums, the sluggers are like almost as bad as a Skinner, but I gotta tell you, I've enjoyed playing them, and they've not only been working, but they've been pretty effective at what they're doing, and especially when I've got units fast enough to kind of not be in the way and pose a bigger threat, they really get the job done for me. They really have.
Well, I'm going to try not to give you a bit of a heart attack here, but I come up with a better solution for protecting the sluggers.
Because
the biggest problem that the sluggers have is unnecessarily people charging them, it's people running to engage them. Because 10-inch range, is difficult for most things to be able to charge to catch that distance. But run is easily accomplished. So my solution was the Winter Troll.
I was waiting for it. I was like, hey, Winter Troll Animus.
Three Winter Trolls.
Yeah.
And then to hide the Winter Trolls, you put them behind five Skinners. No one can see the Winter Trolls, and it's like they're not even there. And you might possibly win by your opponent laughing to death.
Oh, my.
Oh, see, there you go. I knew he was going to. I knew. I knew he'd badmouth him.
Mike has, again, he's lined up his Gunbjorn list with this one. The three Winter Trolls protecting those sluggers is amazing because they're not engaging. At that point, all of those models that have become stationary, even though they are engaged, can't you still shoot at them?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, so you're standing still, you're clearing out everything in front of you with all of those D3 shots. So you're essentially killing everything in front of you and everything within 10 inches in front of you then, and then you'll still have to deal with it with all those Winter Trolls just, pumping those sluggers with that Animus.
It's true, but it means a turn before that your other beasts don't do anything because you just spent 6 Fury trying to throw on the Animus a couple times.
Yeah, but the point is, you don't need to worry about that, because this means that the enemy was at least about 14 inches away, because they weren't in range for your sluggers to just shoot them. So that fury being spent there is fury preparing you for the next turn when they don't have nothing to do for the turn before.
Yeah, against a lot of stuff it'll work, but there's sometimes that you have to worry about the long, like the more rangy stuff. And then you might want Fury for...
Yeah, well, I wouldn't use it with Gunbjorn. I was thinking about that with something more like Jarl. All it takes is one well-placed slugger with the Animus, and he'll protect all of them from being run-engaged.
All right, not to derail this conversation completely, but speaking of Jarl, our shop owner's wife paints like a demon. She's fantastic. Her blog, Jorganic Burger, is currently showcasing her putting together, assembling, and painting Jarl. She's good, and she gets nothing from me plugging her blog, but I got to tell you, she's hands down one of the best painters I've ever seen.
Very nice.
So if you want to check out her progress on Jorganic Burger, I highly recommend it. It's a Blogspot blog.
Well, and speaking of painting exposés, our very own Slap Happy Sid has just recently become engaged to be married. Congratulations to him. And not only that, but he's been invited next Scrumcast to have a painting expose for us to really explain what takes a tabletop model and what he uses to bring that painting experience up and above and more to a show quality model. And
nice.
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking forward to it because, you know, I pioneered the quick and dirty part of it where I'm really bad at painting and I try and get everything done as quick as possible. And so I'm relishing the opportunity to pick his brain a little bit and kind of make my models look better.
If your shop owner's wife is a very good painter, NeonCon, having a cool Mineer Knot is sponsoring a giant painting competition at NeonCon that I forgot to mention. I can almost hear Ross calling me and yelling at me. But there's a big painting competition, Cool Mineer Knot. Winner gets flown to Adepticon to compete in the big Ooh, Crystal Rush.
Very nice.
$10,000 grand prize.
Hey, if I could make it to NeonCon, Pete, I'd come bring my sluggers and skinners and whoop your troll fanny with them.
You might, because I think my trolls are on hiatus until Journeyman League's over because I'm busy painting. Signar.
What?
Hey, I did the same thing. I picked up. I've been playing Searforge for the Journeyman League. Go Merc.
We invited you to a troll podcast and you're playing Signar.
Only for like the last 2 weeks.
Dog.
The new Nemo sculpt is so good.
You know what? The Nemo sculpt is so good. You know why it's so good? Because we got to see Ghoul paint it all at Log and Load and make us all cry at why painting should be like that.
Yes, mine will not look that good.
Jesus. At any rate, gentlemen, thank you for attending this very recent version of the Scrumcast. We'll see you all next month over at trollbloodscrum.com.
Like he's ITT, yeah, what is it? Fucking yeah, ITT Tech, not DeVry. ITT Tech grad, and he does all the RSSS ARF. I'm just gonna add as many S's as I RSS. It's a part web forum and it's part a crack Nazi SWAT team. The RSSS. But he
tremendously.
So does it sound to anyone else like when Dallas talks, there's a baby rattle going in the background?
I assumed he was being attacked by bees, like Nick Cage. And
you know, when he has babies in the house, I assumed it was baby rattles. He just has his kid there in the background.
You might be hearing my frog tank, actually. We've got this little frog here next to the computer.
Why do you have something that's water next to the computer?
Because it makes sense. What are you talking about?
That's just science.
Yeah, so sure it's just a long-term science experiment.
How long can Dallas keep his frog from ruining his computer?
No, it's a
science experiment.
It's a little water frog. It's a little water frog. It's a little, like, one-gallon tank. If it breaks, it'll spill all over the printer, not the case. It's okay.
You know,